So the concept was really about making a journey meaningful to people.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about sending people to beautiful places and understanding a story behind a journey. And I racked my brains for a long time about all the historical journeys, which might be about, I don't know, 3,000 to 5,000 kilometers long. And then I struck upon the idea of what's most iconic and most unusual in history is elephants crossing mountains in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't been done since, apart from by the Carthaginians, and wasn't done before. So it's a unique place in history. There have been migrations of peoples, you know, invasions, wars, you know, but elephants crossing mountains is something which nobody forgets.
This is Dawn, a very unlikely ultra cyclist, and you're listening to the Just Bikes podcast from The Metal Set. Stay tuned as I'll be chatting with friends and fellow cyclists about all things bikes. That's ultra, adventure, gravel, mountain biking, and all sorts of type 2 fun.
We know that bike packing and ultra cycling is about testing your limits, physical and mental. It's about adventure, camaraderie. It is about eating. It's also about storytelling. And as you can hear from the intro snippet to this episode, storytelling is at the heart of one of the newest self-supported ultra cycling races on the calendar, Via Race. I'm super excited that Ingeborg and Ian, the team behind this upcoming race, agreed to speak in their very first podcast with me and my now semi-regular co-host, Neil Copeland, about the first chapter of this 4,000-kilometer race. Neil, among many other familiar faces on the ultra cycling scene, have signed up for the race, which departs from southern Iberia on the 20th of July, 2024, and ends in southern Italy. This is an ultra cycling race for ultra cyclists by ultra cyclists. And there was so much to cover that we've split the episode into two parts. If you're listening to this as soon as it's published, expect part two to drop in a day or two. If you've waited a few days, part two should be live now. Check out the show notes for all the details. In this, part one, we chat with Ingeborg and Ian about the origins of Via Race, which includes their personal stories of cycling and a very cool world record. We discuss the route, the thought behind various race elements, including the importance of storytelling, the dot watching experience, safety, different race categories, support for new riders, and how the race aims to welcome a more diverse lineup of participants. We also discuss the role of the race partners. Don't forget to hit follow as not to miss part two, because in the second part, we dive into what Ian and Ingeborg feel needs to change in ultra cycling, the role of technology, and also the importance of transparency when it comes to rules to ensure a fair and safe adventure for all. We also chat through Neil's setup for the race, the profile of the participants, and also if I decide to put my hat in the ring for chapter two. I've also included the voices of some of those participating, so don't miss it. This chat highlighted everything I love about the ultra cycling and bikepacking community, and also how the sport is growing and evolving. Without further ado, here's part one of our chat with Ian and Ingeborg about Via Race. Enjoy. So hello, everyone. Welcome to the Just Bikes podcast. I am joined by a very special co-host today that some of you listening will already know because he's co-hosted with me before, Neil Copeland. And we have two guests today, Ian and Ingeborg from Via Race, which is one of the newest self-supported ultra cycling races on the calendar. So we're really excited to have everyone here. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, Dawn. Good to be back.
Yeah, good to be back after our failed attempt at Rwanda co-hosting.
We tried.
We did try. But anyways, we're back now. There's no tech issues. I guess I want to dive right into it. Ingeborg, Ian, what is Via Race?
It's a new 4,000-kilometer race across Europe, following the great footsteps of the Carthaginian general Hannibal, who took his elephants from the south of Spain, across the Pyrenees, across the Alps to invade Italy and fight the Roman Republic. So the race starts in Cartagena in Spain, southern Spain, and finishes in Giovinazzo in southern Italy.
I mean, it sounds amazing, and as you know, I've been interested in this since we very first spoke about it, Ian and Ingeborg, and hence I'm sure we'll get onto this later. I am going to be taking part, but let's take a step back first. How did you both get involved in ultra cycling? Tell us about your history on the bike, your history with some of the races, and you know how that led to the creation of Via Race.
Maybe I'll start. I started cycling, I guess, again. I learned to use a bike when I was a child, but I started cycling again through a cycle to work scheme, and then things kind of snowballed from there. Someone said, "Oh, try this sort of Dunwich Dynamo. You cycle overnight." And I said, "Oh, no. That sounds crazy. That's far too long for me." And you know, then the next thing came up, and I said, no, who cycles over mountains in the Alps? I would never do that. You must be crazy. And then I found myself doing one of the sort of sportives that would be doing that. And one day someone talked to me about ultra cycling, and I said, that is absolutely nuts. That's just crazy. Who does that? And then it lingered on my mind, and the next year I was sort of signing up for a 4,000-kilometer race, and that was my first. I hadn't done more than a sort of a 200-kilometer ride before that, and that obviously focused the mind very much on training in the sort of the six months up until the race, and. I ended up, I guess, surprising myself and my friends and family that I not only finished, but I actually finished as the second woman. And, you know, from there on, I guess I've just enjoyed what is a combination of, you know, fitness, but it's not just that. There's so many more things. There's route planning, there's supply, there's when you sleep, how you think on your feet, make decisions when you're tired. All of these things play in, which makes it a lot more interesting than many other sports. So I've since then, since 2017, I've sort of been doing a few events each year. I have not done a 4,000 kilometer since, and I think it will be difficult to fit that in while you're organizing.
Yeah, I think that would be a very big challenge, I think, to be both the organizer and doing the race.
Was there a particular moment in that first race where you realized that you were hooked on ultra racing, or that you were falling in love with this? You know, what is a particularly unique and very niche part of the sport?
I guess for me, I came into it very hesitant, and you know, I'm sure we'll talk about it later in the podcast as well. I think many women perhaps have a bit of that, especially when you haven't done it before. I was like, can I really do this? How far will I get? So many people tend to scratch. So I started out very, very cautiously and didn't want to be going too long each day, managing it, all of that. And then I got about halfway, and I, you know, someone said, "Oh, you know, you're actually the third woman," and I couldn't believe it. And all of a sudden, you're like, actually, I can do this. And the feeling of sort of achievement that you get when you see that you can do more than you think, the body is capable of more than you think it is. I think that was sort of the turning point for me, that I actually could do it. And the second half of the race was much faster than the first half. I think I've just, you know, it really enjoyed that sense since then.
And Ian, what about you? Did you start in 2017 as well?
If I go back to the beginning, when I was a child, I used to swim quite a bit. So I used to swim at about county level. I held some pool records. I was pretty fast, and I used to win backstroke competitions without even thinking about it. But I gave up swimming in my early teens, probably about 14. And cycling didn't really factor very much into it. I used to find riding up a local hill, which was not much more than 30 meters, quite difficult. And maybe I didn't even manage to get up it without walking. And I only really came to cycling in my early 20s. Just like Ingeborg, I started riding to work, and it was a mile and a half downhill, mostly downhill. And then I would have to tackle that same local hill on the way back home. And I didn't know if I could do it. But then one day I did. I managed to ride up the whole hill without walking. And then it became, oh, how fast can I do it? And then I got a road bike. And then I went further and further and further until I was doing 100-mile rides, I was road racing, and I kind of gave it all up, had started a family, and really came to ultra cycling in an odd way, which was trying to almost unconsciously escape from somebody in my life at the time. And cycling long distance was that way of escaping, until I was doing sort of 300K a day one way, 300K back. And then one of my friends said, oh, you should watch this film on YouTube. It's about a 4,000 kilometer race. It just happened to be the same sort of race that Ingeborg was talking about. And he said, oh, you should do this. And I watched this film. I thought, these two guys, they seem to be screwing up absolutely everything, doing everything wrong. They're riding slowly. They're just a couple of clowns. I can do this better than them. So I applied in 2015 for the 2016 race. I didn't get in. So I did three other ultra races, and I won them all in the first year.
Wow.
I thought, oh, I'm quite good at this. And actually, I really enjoy it. And part of it was traveling. Part of it was meeting people. And part of it was also the racing aspect in competing with other people, and seeing where my limits were. And in that year, I didn't really find my limits. And then in 2017, I did exactly the same race. And met Ingeborg at the end of this 4,000K, where we exchanged some, I think, food tips and then race tips, and then we became good friends. And I've done 24-hour time trials. I think I've done something like 14 ultra events, and I've won maybe half of them.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's ultra cycling for me. Where the best things are the people that you meet. So meeting people like Ingeborg, meeting Neil Copeland, your co-host, and many other fantastic people, where, you know, you just become firm friends because you share such a niche set of values and passions that you hit it off with them very easily. So there has barely been an ultra cyclist that I haven't really liked and become really good friends with.
And the good news is that Ian is no longer doing it to escape someone.
That's good.
And occasionally we do these things together on tandem. So that's added another dimension when we show up to an event on a tandem.
They were spotted in the wild by one of my coaching clients yesterday, out doing a lap of Kent in the rain. I'm fascinated about the tandem.
I am too, because I think, like, I'm very much a lone wolf when it comes to these races. Like, I don't know anyone that I know who I could do a race with as a pair, just because I do like the solitude. I like being alone, and I like making my own decisions. I don't want to have to consider anyone. And I think having another person in a pair is one thing. Having another person you're pretty much attached to by a bike is like, my mind is like, I can't comprehend.
At least as a pair, you can separate a little bit, get some space, get some time on your own. You know, you're, who's the stoker and who's the steerer?
So I'm the stoker, I'm at the back.
And I'm the captain, so I do all the steering, the braking, the gear changes, and most of the navigation.
And then she has to sit Ian.
She has to sit behind your ass for however long, Ian. I mean, it's
a great answer. What can I say?
Oh, and what's been the best? Well, should I say achievement or just the one that was the most fun? What was your best achievement on the tandem?
Well, the hardest one was the 24-hour time trial last year, which was the UK National Championships held on open roads. And there was 34 millimeters of rain in 24 hours. It was not a flat course. So there was something like 3,500 meters of climbing. And we took the record by, what, 2K?
2K,
2 yeah. kilometers. We broke the 21-year-old record by 2K over 24 hours, having suffered so many mechanicals that we were off the bike for an hour and a half.
Oh, no.
So we managed to break it in 22 and a half hours.
And it'll be another 21 years before anybody comes along crazy enough to want to do this again. So I think your record's probably safe for a while.
Well, this could be a call to challenge for anyone listening.
It would be great to see someone out there attempting it, actually, because it always puts a smile on our face when we see other people out there on a tandem because they are fun. And I think, I mean, it was a challenging event, and I don't think we're sort of racing to get back to do it. But if we spent an hour and a half off the bike, then I think someone else should be able to take it. Although I think for me, 750 kilometers in 24 hours is, of course, inconceivable on my own.
Mm.
I mean, it's a totally beatable record. And it's a story in itself. We would take quite a long time because the number of perspectives of the story where, you know, it's not just us riding the bike. It's also we had a crew who helped us, change our bike, feed us, helped to fix the bikes, repeatedly fix the bikes. And full credit to them, our friends, other cyclists, and two daughters, along for a very wet night. It was, you know, incredible support. I think that's probably our biggest achievement so far.
And sorry,
I'm sold. I'm going to start Googling for a tandem.
You and Laura.
Put one up on eBay. Yeah, yeah. My wife's pretty handy on a bike. So, we should give it a go.
The saying with a tandem is it will take your relationship faster in whichever direction it's going.
Okay.
There you go.
trusting each other is a big thing.
Yeah.
If you trust each other, that's great because, you know, a lot of people think they see a tandem go past and they think, oh, they've just got such an advantage. And this was one of the things in All Points North last year where we entered as a pair against other pairs and we won pairs category. And lots
on
of
a tandem?
People, on the tandem, yeah.
Right, yeah.
I think we also had a couple who are our friends. They won the rookie pairs category as well on a tandem.
Mm.
And they will also be turning up to VIA on a tandem, which is great because we love tandems. And there's another tandem who also wants to do VIA. So that's another story.
Amazing. Just to go back, what was the distance you did in the 24-hour time trial?
I can't remember exactly.
It's 465.77 miles, which is 750 something kilometers.
Oh my goodness, that is wild.
I just can't.
You're giving Neil ideas now.
I can't get my head around that kind of speed. That's insane.
But now Neil's like thinking about pairs, aren't you?
I'm thinking about tandems.
Yeah.
I like, where could you take a tandem?
Mm. Well, so one of the things that you and I discussed, Neil, previously was what we would like to do on a tandem. Because, you know, if we if we didn't have kids and didn't have job and had enough money to do everything that we wanted to do, and it's obviously time, energy, and money, we'd do round the world. So we'd go for, you know, the circumnavigation record.
But I wasn't aware that there was another record we were planning to go for.
Is this all news?
Well, yeah. If we weren't doing VIA, then we would be doing the end-to-end record from Land's End to John O'Groats. So we discussed that with our team, and they said, "Yeah, let's do it."
And what's the record for that?
Conclude 52 hours for a mix hours. For a mixed tandem?
52 hours for the mixed tandem record.
I just love the fact that this is one of the unique quirks of time trials, right? Which is very different to ultra racing. There's a record for everything. And there's record in all these different categories, like mixed tandem, Land's End to John O'Groats. I love that.
Yeah.
And did you know that there's no women's record for tandem?
Right, okay.
So anyone who does it is just going to get the record.
Yeah, either for 24 hours or for the end-to-end. So there's been no women pair who have done this.
Does that tempt you, Ingeborg?
Dawn?
I need to train a bit.
I think there may be a pair that we know that may attempt it on a tandem this year, actually. Someone that we know through ultra cycling, she has I don't know if she's gone official about this. I won't mention who it is, but we know of someone who's planning an all-female tandem record, which will be the first one. So,
no, very cool.
I'm going to have to chat to some of my female clients, because I think we can stoke up some interest in this.
Yeah, maybe get a competition going there.
And we'll come and support on the 24-hour if it doesn't coincide with VIA, which it probably does. But,
which it always does.
But, you know, it's we love tandems, but we probably talked enough about tandems now, because it is quite niche, and we know that, you know, it's not everyone's interest to feel, sort of field of interest.
I think it's even more niche than ultra cycling. Okay, so we, you know, thanks for that. That's a really good understanding of kind of, you know, how you got into this, where that passion and that motivation comes from. So how do you go from there to one day saying, sitting down over the dinner table going, do you know what, why don't we organize our own race? How did that come about, and how did you get the inspiration for the concept?
That is probably Ian's story more than mine.
So the concept was really about making a journey meaningful to people. It's really about sending people to beautiful places and understanding a story behind a journey. And I racked my brains for a long time about all the historical journeys, which might be about, I don't know, 3,000 to 5,000 kilometers long. And then I struck upon the idea of what's most iconic and most unusual in history is elephants crossing mountains in Europe. Hasn't been done since, apart from by the Carthaginians, and wasn't done before. So it's a unique place in history. There have been migrations of peoples, you know, invasions, wars, you know, but elephants crossing mountains is something which nobody forgets. And whenever you mention Hannibal, everybody remembers elephants crossing mountains, crossing through snowy peaks, undergoing great hardship, but making it to Italy with some elephants surviving. So that was really the concept. Rather than sending people to, say, I don't know, 3 or 4 random, brutal places with just really steep parkour and saying, this is really hard, this is really high, and we've just picked this place randomly across Europe. So following the footsteps of somebody who is well known in history, and giving the journey purpose, as well as having a kind of a race to go along with it. And why we came up with it is a slightly different story.
Go on. You're looking at my backstory. So, I mean, we both race and we avidly follow the races that take place because we have friends who are in practically everything. And, you know, it was last summer that our sort of we felt this, desire to set up something. And that was to create the best experience for a community that is our friends. And we felt like there was really room for a race, which is a road race, a long road race with great competition, community, and then combining that with that adventure of a journey that has a meaning. Mm-hmm. And that is really how Via was born. It was as we were sort of watching and seeing things unfold, feeling that here was something where we could create a great experience for the community that we really care about. It's probably fair to say that we have certainly questioned it at some points, because it would be much easier to just go and do other people's races and enjoy the racing that we've always done. But we really felt like there was something to be added, that there was room for something a bit different, and that's what we want to create with Via.
And we really wanted to give to the community, because we have done, I don't know, between us 20 odd ultra races, and it's always great to see organizers, volunteers who they're passionate about the sport and the people. They really care, and they put a lot of effort, and it is a lot of effort to organize a race, especially across Europe. And so this is our contribution to the community, to offer the best of the experience possible, and learning from many of the mistakes that other races have made, but also learning what was really great for us to experience, and taking the best bits and thinking, how do we avoid the worst bits? So treating people fairly, making sure that it's accessible to people, making sure it's accessible to underrepresented groups. Reducing the financial barriers or any sort of barriers, be it perceived or physical, economic. I think that's why we came up with this race, is to do the best that we can, because the community does actually deserve it.
It's funny. Not funny, it's nice, like, hearing this, because I think, this podcast certainly exists because of ultra cycling, because my entry into ultra cycling. And just coming back from Rwanda, I actually met Simon, the organizer, on the first race. We drove together from Dubai here to Biking Man Oman, so that was his first race. And to see how, those two things, our paths are a bit different, but also resulted in something that we're giving back to the community. So it's really nice to hear that for you guys as well, for this particular race. A couple of things you touched upon, and that you mentioned it, with the storytelling. This is chapter one of a 3-chapter race, correct?
That's correct.
So it's not going to be the same next year, right? It's going to pick up where it left off. Can you talk me through that a bit? I've got some more specific questions around, how it's different and what learnings you have, but I'm just really curious to understand, because it's only 3 chapters, right? This is the one. So this is the first out of 3. So talk me through a little bit about that, this being the first chapter, what's chapter 2 and what's chapter 3 as well?
So chapter 2, we will announce at the end of the race of chapter 1, and we will announce it at the finishing line when we have the celebration for everybody getting to the finish, regardless of whether they've had to ride there or whether they've broken down and managed to make it to the finish, because we do want to ensure that everybody feels like they have participated and they are part of the community, that their journey doesn't end if they have to scratch DNF. For whatever reason. So it's not just about those who successfully make it purely by bike and their own power. Chapter 2 is a different historical story. And I'm sorry, it's going to be a nice surprise for everybody.
Oh.
But it sounds like you have that story already, because
it is another historical story which starts in the south of Italy and it will go somewhere completely different. So it will start at the finish, chapter one, and chapter two will end somewhere completely different, and chapter two will then conclude. Chapter three will start from the end of chapter two and finish somewhere completely differently. And that will be another story. And they're all sort of Roman themes. And I've had to think long and hard about the routing of them and the distance. But it's also considering safety. So Romanian bears need not feature.
Okay, great.
Nor the much more common Greek dogs. We are not going anywhere near war zones, so we are very much staying in mostly Western Europe. So watch this space, because safety is part of having the best experiences.
Mm-hmm.
We do want everybody to be safe. We don't want anybody to be hurt in any way. So we're reducing the risks for people. And the world's a big place. You know, Europe's a massive place. And there's so much which is unexplored. And that's part of our philosophy. Part of our aim is to race the unexplored. Parts where lots of races just avoid. And I have no idea why. We've discussed why and discussed, you know, this would be a beautiful place and that would be a beautiful place. And just to think about how we can include them in the story, in the route.
So, I mean, just to pick up on your point there about creating a safe race and that being important. Now, you know, Via Race is a self-routed race. So for those of you listening who maybe aren't aware of what that means, it means there will be a series of fixed checkpoints. And between those checkpoints, we have to define our own route. How do you go about ensuring safety under those that kind of scenario, because it's quite challenging, because you've got no control over the roads people take, so you know, how have you addressed that?
So we have stuck with Western Europe being very safe compared to many parts of the world. And I think, having done some races further east in Europe, you know, the east of Europe is far less safe due to fewer cyclists, much more heavy traffic, more dogs, worse road surfaces, just less cycling culture. Whereas we are routing riders through Spain, France, and Italy, you know, three of the most cycling avid countries. So that's where the majority of the safety issues are. They're just not to be worried about so much. The second part is understanding where the busy areas of these countries are, and they're typically coastal. So the south coast of France, the east coast of Spain, closer to Barcelona, the coastal regions of Italy. And coming up with what we call gates, which are just mandatory points where riders have to go through. We also have a concept of refuges, which are two places, one just outside the Pyrenees and one in the Alps, which are much more than a checkpoint, because there are places where there are facilities to use. There are some basic supplies like, you know, food, water, maybe some spares, somewhere to sleep, under shelter. It's much more accommodating than your traditional checkpoint would be. So all these mandatory points that we have chosen are safe places. And between point to point, they are also safe routes. So that's how we guide riders to free route efficiently and quickly. Between these mandatory points, there are no real busy areas. So that keeps riders safe, and it also allows riders to choose as they wish, because we do believe in individual choice. And it is part of our core values to democratize the sport a lot more, so that it's not a hierarchical kind of look up to us as the organization. We'll tell you what to do. We're the authority. It's much more, we're like you. We're ultra cyclists. Mm-hmm. We know what you're going through. So understanding who you are, what you need, what you want, we can give that to you. And most people want a good challenge. That's why most people do it. Some people want to race. Some people want to race others. Others want to race the time limits and push their limits. But everybody wants a great adventure and to make friends. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we're very keen on, is to create a stronger community and grow that community.
And I think what we haven't talked about yet is perhaps the Dot Watcher experience. Mm. And that is another place where I think free routing is more interesting to watch. Mm. I mean, when you can comment on what the choices different people are making and wonder what, you know, why is someone going over here, it becomes a lot more interesting to watch it. So I think that's an interesting part of the adventure. Dot watching is something that we have thought quite a lot about, because we love the sport. We think the sport is the best sport. Mm-hmm. So few people know about it, and it's difficult. It's quite difficult to follow if you're not in the know. Mm-hmm. So we will be putting quite a lot of focus. So between now, you know, we closed registrations, we processed everyone, etc. Quite a lot of our time is spent on how do we create the best spectating experience so that we can get more rider stories out there. Mm-hmm. Because the best story isn't just at the front of the race or what's captured. It's like everyone will have something that is mm-hmm. worthy of being told. And so we're thinking about both technology and media that will help tell the stories and make it a more immersive experience to follow this race.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, from my perspective, having done a lot of these things, I think you've hit on one of the key points there, that the stories happen throughout
everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And it's certainly been a source of frustration following events with clients being in events myself, that the focus is always who's in the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
How, and I appreciate you may not have reached any final decisions on this yet, but so,
I know a good,
you
know, podcast, what, then mate.
what are your ideas about that? You know, what have you seen being done really, really well elsewhere in the ultra cycling community? You know, what races are doing things interesting in terms of bringing it out to everybody, and where have you got interesting ideas in terms of how you want to take Via Race out to the public?
So to give a shout out to you know, those who make a big success of telling a really good story. You know, Dot Watcher has some great reporters. Petter McSharry, for example. There are quite a few others. You know, Wendy Ellis. You know, people who are really deep into the sport and the dot watching experience. They come up with many very nuanced perspectives. You know, mm-hmm. they know the riders, they know the country, they know the sport inside out. They think about the tactics, the strategy, the equipment. And they give lots of little nuggets of information. So that's one thing. Nelson Trees, through, you know, Silk Road, Atlas Mountain Race, Hellenic, he tells a great story through, you know, the employment of various great storytellers and media professionals who do beautiful videography and beautiful photographs. So that's where you know, people do it really, really well.
Yeah, I think the podcasting from Atlas was particularly good, which Alan Shaw did, which was it felt quite real time and out there, mm-hmm. compared to sometimes, you know, being quite behind what was happening. So I really enjoyed that part. And yeah. If we think about some of the things we're thinking of, I'll reveal a few, and then some will probably be for you to discover. our refuges are places that have a bit more. It's offered more. It's worthwhile stopping. Mm-hmm. Well, that also means that we can capture more stories there, because people won't need to run in and then run out to find food somewhere else if it's late at night. There will be stuff there. So, you know, our idea is that we will have a mandatory stop of 10 to 15 minutes. And that if everyone is doing that, there's no advantage to be gained. But the advantage is that we can capture the stories and hear. And some people, you know, will probably relish in speaking to someone after having been by themselves for more than 1,000 kilometers, whereas others may not particularly like being asked questions. But they will be there for a little period of time. And the fact that you have that same approach for everyone means that you don't only capture, you know, the interesting person at the front, you also capture the interesting person in the middle and the interesting person at the back. So we hope that is something that will help us capture more of the stories through the race. So that's one example of what we or how we're thinking about it.
Yeah, and I think that's it's a really good distinction, that we're not going to have media cars chasing particular riders, because media cars are considered, and I think we are as a team quite agreed about the unfair advantage that it gives to certain riders, especially at the pointy end of the race, where you know, maybe it's the top three get a lot of coverage, and then hardly anybody else gets it. So we are very interested in every single rider and being able to tell their stories to their friends and family back home, and giving them the chance to capture those memories and know that people care about what they're doing.
Yeah.
And people understand how difficult their journey's been so far. And let them just tell the stories of what's gone wrong, because whenever something's gone wrong, there's a huge story to tell.
Yeah.
We've had our share of mechanicals and breakdowns, and even scratching sometimes. And there's always a fascinating story where the rider overcomes some great hardship and survives.
Mm-hmm.
And these are unforgettable memories.
Yeah.
You'll never forget them. And whenever they tell somebody the story of the Romanian bears and the Transfiguration Pass, you know, people remember this.
Yeah. I mean, it's seared in my memory, Romanian bears, that's for sure.
Well, there are bears in Italy. There are wolves across a lot of Western Europe. So
shush, Neil, don't tell me these things. I'll never do it.
You're not racing, Dawn. I'm going to be racing.
No, I know, but maybe I'm considering it, okay, after we're chatting right now.
I'm absolutely terrified.
Wolves are very shy. I've never seen them.
Yeah, they're shy, Neil. We'll just like,
I'm not too worried about the wolves. It is the bears that worry me.
Yeah. I think that's really important. You touch upon something very important. As someone who is never in the front and often feeling like a forgotten stepchild in the back sometimes on these races, I think it's so nice, like the races where I have done and where there is, you know, you see a photography car every now and again. It is such a moral boost, number one, to see someone and to have a quick chat with them for 5 minutes, but also to have those memories going back and just coming from it from a different side of things now, just coming back from Rwanda, it is extremely difficult to cover with the 1,000-kilometer race. We never caught up with the fastest people, which was fine. They're all amazing athletes. There was a lot of attention, you know, people capturing their stories and stuff, but we stuck with the middle and the back. And for me, those are, yeah, really where the really touching, funny, you know, wild tales come from. And it was a really wonderful experience capturing those, as much as there was some tech issues in Rwanda in particular, but it was really, really nice it was a really fulfilling experience for me to capture, and be there from the other side. So that's really exciting to hear that everyone's, you know, there's a focus on getting everyone. And I think having people at the checkpoint is really key. That's kind of my key learning. You need to stay static.
And I think also it is important to remember, you know, these are for many people who do it, it is their main holiday of the year. They take a lot of time out. Therefore, creating a good experience is important. But everyone is the star in their own movie. Mm-hmm. Everyone has got a family, friends, colleagues. At home, colleagues who would like to watch for them and find out what's going on about them. So, you know, I think it is about creating that experience where you have an easy way of sharing the amazing things you go through. And even if you don't meet a bear, or, you know, you don't have something absolutely extraordinary, it is extraordinary to cycle 4,000 kilometers and to be able to have your friends and family cheer on because they know what you're going through. Is it raining where you are? Or, you know, did you go up something particularly difficult? And I think the technology is moving ahead on the ability to tell a lot more individual stories and make it easier for riders to share. So these are things that we're working on.
Oh, that's great. We'll step away from the media thing, but one of the things I do actually love about this is that there is an element of mystery around these races. Like, people have to piece together information to kind of get an overview of what's happening. You need to follow this person, or you go down a bit of a rabbit hole and you listen to this and do this. So I actually think it's quite a unique aspect and fun aspect once people start to get into the dot watching to kind of figure out, you know, how they can kind of fully hear the story of the race and know that there are things that will never be shared because they're just for people individually, you know, for people who are doing the race. And I think that's quite special. Just on the point, because I think representation is so important, I think particularly for women, you know, seeing other women on the race. And just to go back to what you talked about, you know, this is a race by people who race for people in the community. Talk me through some of the measures that you are taking to really include a more diverse race, more diverse lineup of cyclists coming to the race.
Yeah, there are a number of strands to it. And I think, first of all, we have chosen to have perhaps more categories than most races in order to make sure that, you know, there is a category that sort of everyone would feel welcome in. And what we're, you know, women is one thing, but we are really proud that we've got a paracycling category with at least two, possibly more paracyclists who are attempting this, and we think that's sort of the first time. But you open that up by saying that you have an ability to accommodate it. Similarly, for a tandem, there are races that basically say no tandems here, either because it's unfair or it's this or it's that. We think that's a great way for someone who perhaps is not as confident to be able to do it with someone else.
Or partially sighted riders who need a guide, a captain, to ride on the front of the tandem. So it is a great way to be part of that huge adventure.
Mm-hmm. And then we can come to women. And I think one thing we've certainly seen and learned, and I spent a lot of time in the sort of the run-up to launching this, talking to people who have had success in events that are more representative, other areas of cycling where they have succeeded in increasing the percentage of women, and what people who've actually really looked at this have come away with. And there is no silver bullet to it, but
And to mention some of those people that have been really helpful to us in learning about how to encourage more women, you know, Dead Ends and Cake has achieved more than 50% female participation. We've talked to Turning the Cogs about breaking down some of those barriers and reducing the friction points.
Emily Chappell was very helpful. So everyone sort of comes in and wants to actually help with it. And we've got ideas we've not been able to incorporate into this race. But one of the main things is a bit what you're saying, you know, that you see that others are doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Extra encouragement. So we have spent more time reaching out directly two women than we have spent on, you know, other riders, which I guess by definition are men in that in that case. And I think it is something about encouraging even women that I would consider to be really experienced, and you know, I think they will actually do really great, have doubts and wonder whether, you know, they can do it. So just that extra encouragement and putting a focus on it, making sure that there's a place to ask questions, that you're open for it, is something that we've put emphasis on.
To your point, Ingeborg, like, I've seen, you know, I went right into ultra. Like, I bought a bike. I didn't participate in roadie culture. Haven't done really short races, you know, just a couple in my life after I did like the big races or the bigger races. And it's really surprising always to me to see women who I consider amazing cyclists, you know, amazing, amazing, super strong, super confident, really good bike handling, be hesitant or be unconfident when they think about an ultra. And I'm like, I'm only confident in ultra. Maybe it's a bit confidence over confidence, but like, you know, for me, that's kind of, it's amazing and bizarre in the same respect, but you need to show more people, you know, who, more women doing it, right? Like, people get confidence. They're like, oh, well, someone's, so-and-so is doing it, I can do it too.
I totally agree. I mean, from a man's perspective, I think representation's really important. I'm a father of three daughters, you know, three girls, you know, the younger two do cyclocross training, for example, every week, and it's not in our house. It's not a male sport. It is for everybody, and I do want my daughters to grow up with great female role models who think they can do absolutely anything because they have the confidence to do so, and they don't knock themselves down. I'm very surprised to hear some of these really confident women, ultra cyclists, say, "Oh, I don't think I'm good enough. I don't even know if I'll complete." And I'm just like, I have to actually check them and go, "What are you talking about? Why are you saying this?" And then they start questioning themselves. Actually, yeah, why am I doubting myself? So I hear it a lot. And I do want my daughters to grow up in a world where being a woman is not seen as a disadvantage, because it does actually have many advantages. One of them being not being overconfident is definitely...
Pleasure me.
I have to say, I heard your story at the very beginning, Ingeborg, where you said, "I set off slowly because I didn't know that I could do this." And the coach in me is saying, yeah, that's absolutely the right way to race.
Yeah.
The way most men would not race, and which is why they fall down. I have a very interesting take on this from being on TCR number 7 when Fiona Kolbinger won, which I think was massive for the sport, because I am not in the same league as she is, but you want to be racing against the best. And ultra racing is it's a very level sport, because there are so many different elements that go into making somebody successful at this sport. And I think that's really,
it's just not fitness.
A good message out to everybody that's listening is that, you know, it's not about riding fast. It's about riding long. It's about being efficient. It's about having a super strong mindset. It's being dedicated to your race plan. And I want to race against the best. And the best isn't necessarily the guy. And that was a big takeaway for me. But I think also how, you know, we might have a lot of people listening to the podcast who are in that headspace of, I don't know, I am curious, but I don't think I can. How, and you've talked about giving encouragement and reaching out. How can people get in touch? How can people, you know, is there a forum? Is there a contact point? How do they get to come and speak to you, Ingeborg, and say, can I do this?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And hopefully the fact that there is a sort of a woman female face to the race as well helps with that. And we hosted a webinar just for women, and lots of women were interested, even if they were not going to do VIA. And it was more about general advice. We've also set up a women's forum in order to have a safe space. I have to say, you know, I felt when I was going to prepare for my first ultra, I felt like all the things that were there were just too extreme for me. When people start talking to me about gear ratio, so what size of tire you need or which one has got what rolling resistance, you know, I just think, oh my goodness, these people know so much more than me. I mean, who am I here? I just know about how to change my tube if I've had a puncture, and that's sort of where I was. And it's not easy to ask your question in such a forum where it feels like everyone is almost a know-it-all, and you sort of worry that your questions will be too basic. And that was the idea with having spaces for women only. It's not because there are so many, none of the things we've actually discussed have been necessarily women specific. It's just safe isn't the word I'm necessarily looking for here, but it's just an environment where you feel more comfortable sharing the question you have that seem too basic, and where you can share your doubts and you know, realize it's okay that you're not a super mechanic or into the latest gear that's going to give a sort of a 1 watt advantage on the over the knee.
I'm hoping you're having an awesome conversation about tire rolling resistance.
Yeah, I was about to say, don't get Neil started right now on tire pressure.
No, look, I could not agree more. With my clients, I have separate conversation areas for my female clients, because guys can be overwhelming in this space. They really can, and not in a good way. So, you know,
and that's something that we're aware of. So that's why we have a separate women only forum. And people can contact us, and also Ingeborg directly. All the links are on our Instagram and Linktree. So there are many methods to get in touch, and people should feel free to get in touch, because we're real people, and we're here to help, especially where people need some very small advice.
Just going back to some of the inclusive measures, I noticed on the website that it said that you needed to have multi-day event experience with night riding. And it was interesting, Ingeborg, to hear your experience though first, because I was like, how does that gel? Because I've spoken to a lot of ultra cyclists. Like for me, in my first race, I didn't have any multi, you know, albeit it was a shorter race, but I didn't have any multi-day experience. I didn't really know much, to be honest. But would that exclude people who don't have that? Is that how it works? Because I noticed it's linked to something called the Rookie Road Program as well. So I just wanted to ask if you could talk through that.
Yeah, the first thing probably to say is we do want everyone who participates to be safe. And when I signed up, I didn't have the experience. But as I said, I also felt like, you know, I had this real fear of not being prepared enough, which made me do quite a lot in the 6 months leading up to it, which does involve doing multi-day training. Mm-hmm. I think it is difficult to rock up to a 4,000-kilometer race and not in your preparation having done more than a one-day ride. So it's more that you need to expect to be there in order to be safe. You don't have to have that experience to sign up, but we want people to tell us about their experience so we can point them in the direction of coaches, programs, information that would help get to the start, having taken into consideration things that are really important, like what kit do I bring for the mountains? What does it mean to sleep outside? Have I thought through those strategies? What if it's really hot? What do I do? Have I thought about this in advance? Those are the sorts of things that you learn a lot about through experience and going out and doing it, or talking to experienced people. And we want to make sure that even if you're new to the sport, we can direct you towards information, coaches, resources to help with that.
And it's true to say that we have attracted a lot of experienced riders who are very confident, having done multi-day events, you know, anything long we consider from 2,500 to even up to 4,000 or 7,000 kilometers long, you know, from Transiberica, Three Peaks bike race to Trans Am. We're very confident these people know what they're doing and we don't have to worry about them so much because they have done all these things. They know what kit to do. They know what training to do. They know how to look after themselves. And that's what's really important to us is that everybody stays safe.
Mm-hmm.
Staying safe is number one to having the best experience because,
But it's actually a good point there because we have had some feedback that some women in particular could be put off by this. And it's a little bit like in work life, the evidence shows that perhaps a man will apply for a job if he's got 60% of the experience required, whereas the woman is sort of not sure, even if she has 100%. So it is something that we heard some feedback on and we thought about what to do about. We have put in place some different measures. So for women, we have what we call sort of a wait list. So if you're not sure, will I have time to build up that experience? Are there things in my life that I can't control? You know, I don't need to make the full commitment as early as perhaps others, just because we want to make it easier and remove many of the barriers that may be there for women and other underrepresented groups in particular. So that's one of the things we've come up with, which perhaps make you feel more confident signing up, because you can perhaps more easily pull out or change your mind or make sure that you get that training then that you feel like you need to do.
You mentioned the rookie road. So originally we had envisioned a number of ultra cycling specific coaches who are very experienced, and your co-host was one of them. So to have these coaches be able to talk to a number of riders. And you're really enjoying those.
Sorry, for anyone just listening to the audio of this, Neil's got some program that, I don't know, it's fireworks, balloons.
Lots of fun stuff.
Sorry, Ian.
to connect riders who have less experience with coaches who can either take them on as clients or talk to them in webinars. And host them in various events, which are primarily designed for coaching, such as both Neil and Yasmin Muller's Dot Booster training camp. So these are all great ways to improve the experience of people and ensure that they are both safe and successful, whatever success means to them. And we've also thought about having a buddy system where we pair up two different riders of differing levels of experience. And then, you know, we're strengthening the community as well as being that kind of knowledge transfer.
That's really nice to hear.
The other part of the rookie road program is something that our partners have enabled us to do, which is if you're quite new to it, there is a lot of kit that you sort of need to accumulate. Some of those of us who've done it for some time, you accumulate it over the years. So our partners, Café du Cycliste and Cyclide, so clothing and bikepacking bags, are providing rookies, some sort of number of the rookies we have, with kit in order to, again, enable people who perhaps are new to the sport to get into it and to have the right equipment.
And I think it's really a very generous offer by these two of our major partners to help reduce that financial burden on rookies, because cycling is an expensive sport, and unless it is your major holiday for the year, it's hard to fathom the sort of expense. So we managed to negotiate with them, and they very generously agreed to help kit out a number of rookies and that should help to reduce that difficulty in be able to participate in VR.
Love that. Yeah, really important, I think. Looking back now, like as you said, it's just kind of now part of, you know, I probably have more Lycra than normal clothes in my closet. Really? I'm like, how did this happen?
I am not going to talk about the number of bike packing bags I have stashed.
Yeah,
away
it just kind of accumulates. But at first, yeah, it is a real financial, you know, it can be a financial burden for people. So that's really fantastic to hear that the partners are coming on board for that. I love Cafe de Cyclist, by the way. I'm always wearing Cafe de Cyclist kit in ultra racing, so I can vouch for them. They're good. Never had any problems.
If you have too many bike packing bags, you can give some away.
There you go. Like,
because it's on the forum. We've got a topic set up.
That's a very good idea. I do have far too many bags.
We do too, and we've been giving them away. The girls have inherited them for our bike packing family holidays as well. So yeah, I think it's we all have too much kit, especially in ultra cycling, where we experiment with different things. Some things don't work. Things work better. So we just have this stash of accumulated, very expensive kit, very often, which we have found some good homes for them.
Before every race, like 2 months out from every race I've done, really for the last 4 years, I've been convinced that I couldn't possibly need anything else. And you can guarantee that with a week to go, there's just panic deliveries coming in from all over the globe because I've realized that I
just throwing money at the problem
absolutely needs to be completely different. Yes. So I will check out that part of the forum. I think that's a great way of helping connect people in and help, because it won't just come with a bag. It will come with a story and some advice and some help.
Yeah. I love the buddy system too.
Yeah, I just want to pick up and do a shameless plug there. You talked about the Dock Booster training camps. For anybody who is interested in a 1 week crash course in all of the kind of fundamental skills and things you need to know about to take on an ultra race, then yeah, Yasmin Muller and I run Dock Booster training camps. We still have spaces available for this May. It's 1 week. It will be in Brecon in Wales. And if last year is anything to go by, the weather will be glorious.
Always is in Wales.
Wales never fails. So do find us at dotbooster.com or at dotbooster academy on Instagram.
All right. Ad breakover. Let's go back to the podcast. We talked about many different elements of the race and how things are different. I guess all of this is a response to what you felt needed to be changed, right? Like in the ultra cycling world. And Neil and I have often had these discussions about, you know, for me, when I think about a race, I think one of the things that's really important for me is clarity on the route, you know, what kind of surface, like very plain language. And there's been an organization called She Races, and I think it's very important, particularly for women, to have very clear understanding about what they're getting into. And sometimes when things are like, haha, oh, cute, you know, being cutesy to like hide information, I'm like, no, do not surprise me on this race, or do not mislead me about what I'm prepared to do, because it helps inform like how you prepare for it and how you prepare your bike and everything. So sorry, just going back, my big roundabout way of asking is like, what things, not necessarily for this race, but in general, did you think needed to be changed within the ultra cycling community?
There you have it. That is part one of our chat with Ingeborg and Ian about Via Race. As I mentioned, check out the show notes for links and resources. And as I have left you hanging, don't forget to hit follow to ensure that you don't miss part two for an open discussion on the current state of ultra cycling. In part two, we also chat about transparency when it comes to rules and fostering a fair and safe adventure. Neil also chats through his setup for the race. And beyond Neil, three participants have also shared their voices with me for you, too, to hear about their motivations for joining and what they're most looking forward to. If you like this episode, why not give us a little kudos? 5 stars only, wherever you're listening to this podcast. And remember, sharing is caring. Thank you for listening.